Some of you may have been in the previous session in this room. If so, the introduction will be superfluous. Others of you, however, have come in and we want to introduce our speaker to you so that we might be properly introduced and understand his background. Those of us in the Stewardship Council first came to know Russ a few years ago when he spoke to us in one of the earliest sessions and made a tremendous impression on all of us who were a part of the organization at that time. I'm sure that all of you who are here have perhaps at some time or another read a Russ Reed letter, even though you may not have seen his signature. The chairman of the Board of Christian Education, a member of the executive committee, an active layman in that church. Russ trained at Canadian Bible College and in Seattle Pacific College, and went from Seattle Pacific to the general managership of a Seattle radio station, served in the years 59 through 64 as the vice president of marketing for Word Incorporated, and from 64 until the present time has been president of the Russ Reed Company in Park Ridge. You have seen his ads, you have read his letters, and we're delighted to have him with us today to tell us how to do it in the area of direct mail. Lord bless you, Russ, and thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Well, I'm glad to be here. I hope that the assignment is not more than's possible to achieve when it says that I'm going to tell you how to do it in direct mail. That's like telling you that I'm going to instruct you in how to get along with your wife in one easy lesson. That subject has many, many facets, and direct mail is in the same category. And the one thing about direct mail that continues to astonish me is that it doesn't matter how long you're in the field, you're always learning. And it's not something that's an exact science so that we can stand up here today and say this is the way to do it. All we can do is, from our experience, try to give you some guidelines and principles, and then let you try to fit them into your own particular situation. I'd like to do what a preacher is supposed to do, tell you what I'm going to say, then say it, and then review it, and then tell you what I said. And I'm going to start out by talking about some of the specific applications of direct mail. Then we're going to show some slides in these different areas, and by no means is it exhaustive. There are many other types of applications of direct mail that we'll not discuss today because they are not apropos to the experience or work that most of you are in. After we've talked about the different types and applications of direct mail, I would like to show you a few case studies. Now, anytime we do this, we can be accused of selling, and I'm not really selling, but I can't tell you the success story of anybody but someone I've worked with, and I purposely will eliminate the failures because you won't learn anything from that, and it will just embarrass me. So suffice it to say that in 4.5 years of being in business for myself, we've had some colossal failures. And when we go to work for a client, we always tell them that that's probably going to be one of the things that will happen, is that we'll create a campaign that won't work. And we hope that he's patient enough with us so that in the long run, we have more successes than failures. And I guess really that's the way you keep a client. If the balance seems to be on the favor, on the side of success, you're in good shape. I said to somebody the other day that if a mailing works, God gets the credit. If it fails, I get the blame. And I think sometimes we attach tremendous spiritual significance to things that God expects us to do for ourselves. I said in the last seminar that sometimes in Christian organizations, we tend to feel because we're in God's work that things are going to go all right anyway. And I don't think that's any substitute for hard work and diligent application of ourselves and learning the skills that God has called us to do. Direct mail is an exciting field. We were talking last seminar about space, and we were talking about the opportunity of articulating your ministry. And if that's true in space, it's much more true in direct mail, because you have an opportunity to talk to somebody in a very personable, intimate manner and share with them what's on your heart. If you do it effectively, It not only can bring great financial returns, but it can build for you a loyal constituency who believe in what you're doing and will continue to support your efforts. For the purposes of our discussion today, we're going to talk about three different applications of direct mail. The first one is follow-up to inquiries. And this really, in a sense, is the tag end of the last seminar, although we didn't cover it there. You can spend all the money in the world on an effective space program and put your coupon in the right place and have all the offers in line. But if when you get that coupon, you don't do anything with it, you're wasting money. And I had one of my people write to several organizations that are here today and ask them for information before I came so I'd see how well you do in answering your responses. And you're terrible. You're just terrible. The letters are bad. It took forever to get a response. And so I hope that maybe after today that we can lay down some guidelines that'll help you to go into that department, whoever it is responsible, and get them on a daily basis of answering inquiries. And then making sure you look at all those letters to see if they're really saying what you want them to say. I was very unfair of me to do that, but I'm just a little guy and I need to have an edge. And I just figured if I wrote like that, it would just give me the necessary confidence so that I could get through this hour without being felt like I was being abused. So you'll have to forgive me. So following up inquiries is the first application of direct mail. I want to show you some slides, and I'd appreciate it if the lights could be turned out so we can show you a sample campaign for following up an inquiry. Now, unfortunately, this is not... Whoops. I don't remember that face in that campaign. Somebody's... And it's in upside down. What we have here is a follow-up campaign to inquiries about a youth publication curriculum. The people are told in the ad that they will receive something free if they'll write to us. And, of course, we get inquiries and success with youth from different sources, personal recommendations, space ads, whatever. When that inquiry comes in, the advertising department at Success with Youth is set up to respond. I think we can get a little better focus there. There we have it. Now, I want you to look in the lower right-hand corner because this is what we start with. It's the envelope. This is the carrier of your message. Now, these people have written. Now, they forget that it takes 5 to 10 days to get a letter to an office, and they forget that it takes 5 to 10 days for it to get back. So it's very important that the minute that inquiry comes in for annuities, for college, for more information about your organization, that you set your organization up so that they can answer that inquiry immediately. And there's one other thing that's very important. That is that you code your coupon so you can tell exactly where it came from. Because in your advertising program, if you're using space, if you're using Christian Life and Moody Monthly and Christianity Today and World Vision, you'll want to know after a year which of those magazines is pulling leads for you profitably. If you do not code your coupon, it'll be impossible for you to know that. So when the coupon comes in, the girl who handles that for Success with Youth records the code and then makes it possible for this amount of information to go out. Now you say, my, that's an awful lot of information when they just asked for, just expressed interest. Well, remember, this is the personal salesman that's going out to sell your product. You to take a person to lunch and you had in mind to ask them for $1,000, you probably wouldn't wait until the dessert was served and then only suggest that if it was something that they thought they might want to do, that they sometime in the distant future could call you and look your name up in the telephone directory if you hadn't moved. But that's basically what much direct mail does. It doesn't ask for the order. Now, that person's been waiting for 2 whole weeks, even in an efficient operation, for something from you. So we say, first of all, here's the Omega information you requested. And then we sell on the outside envelope, special offer, savings up to $15 inside. When they open it up, there's a letter. There's a brochure. Now this brochure inside tells all the different services that Success with Youth has. And then we have a response device. Now, you have right here the basic elements of any direct mail kit. An outer envelope, a letter, a brochure, a response device, and a business reply envelope, or a BRE. Now, any time you're going into the mail, if you expect to get a response, you need to go with all of your guns loaded. Some people feel if they just slip a brochure in the mail, no covering letter, and no response device, that they're going to get a response. A direct mail kit can be likened to a direct sales presentation. You've all experienced having a vacuum cleaner salesman come into your home. Now, he'll talk and he'll create need and he'll tell you about all the benefits of his vacuum cleaner, but then finally he'll get to the place where he'll demonstrate that vacuum cleaner. Now, the sales pitch is the letter. The brochure is the demonstration. They must be tied together. You must cover the same information in both, but in one you're using highly emotional toned words and copy. In the other, you're giving them the benefits and the facts that relate to the product. Now, this really doesn't matter whether it's annuities, whether it's a school program, whether it's a nonprofit missionary organization, or whether it's a merchandising program like this. These principles still have to be followed. Now, the response device. Let's talk about that for just a minute. Many times, a coupon is buried in a brochure. The most important thing in that whole piece, except the offer, which is, of course, what will get them to respond, is that response card. Make it bright, make it easy to fill out, and then give them an envelope to return it in. This is very, very important. Well, this customer comes in and he writes and he says he wants information. So that's the first package he gets. Now, we wait 3 weeks and we don't hear from him. And let's have the next slide. Now, what we have here is an identical kit, except for two elements. We've added a memo to a carbon of the letter. And basically what we're saying is that we're surprised that he hasn't responded yet. And we know how anxious he is to have a youth program in his church that is meaningful and relevant, and we know how hard it is to get materials, and this offer is still on, and we hope he'll respond immediately. We wait another 3 weeks. And then we send them the next slide. And this, we don't send them a brochure again. We send them a number 10 envelope, so it has a different feel. We put urgency into the envelope by saying special dated offer to success with youth customers only. And then we send that out to him as the third in a series of follow-up letters. If he doesn't respond to that, he goes into what we call an inactive inquiry list, and he's mailed to 4 or 5 times a year with a special direct mail kit to try to interest him again. So you see, really the philosophy with a prospect is you mail to him until he buys or dies. And if any of you wonder if this is profitable or not, all you have to do is follow a renewal program for a major magazine. Time Magazine just doesn't send you one renewal. They send 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. Now, at some point, it becomes not profitable. It could be the 5th or the 6th renewal. Then they stop. But as long as it's profitable for them to mail reminders, they'll mail them. So why shouldn't we use the same methods with dignity in our organizations? All right, let's go to the next application of direct mail. And this is merchandise. And this doesn't apply to too many people here, but I thought it might be interesting for you to see a Word Book Club kit. You'll notice a discrepancy here, and I could tell you that I planned it this way, but I didn't. You'll notice on the letter, the offer is any 3 free. You'll notice on the brochure, it's any 3 for $1. Now, obviously, they didn't go into the same envelope, I hope. But we were testing 2 different offers. And I covered this in the last seminar when we talked about the space. And here we found that any 3 for $1 worked better than any 3 free. But here again, we have all the elements of a direct mail kit. Now here, instead of this being a response to an inquiry, we're going out to lists that we rent from magazines and from organizations, and we're asking them to join the Word Book Club. We need to get an order back from this if it's going to pay out. But we have, again, the elements of a direct mail kit. We have an envelope, which states the offer clearly and demonstrates product. We have a letter. We have an order form. We have a BRE. And we have a brochure. This kit has been used now for 3 different mailings. It'll be dropped again this fall to about 2 million people. And all we'll do is change the outer envelope so that it still will have the same offer because it's working well, but we'll change the graphics because we wouldn't want you to get it and say, oh, I've seen that already. And so we'll change the graphics so that you will again go inside because obviously there'll be new product inside in the introductory offer to the club. Let's have the next slide. Here's a World Vision magazine kit. Now, we started working with World Vision magazine about 3 years ago, and if you remember, they had a house organ called World Vision. And about 3.5 or 4 years ago, they decided to separate their house organ from a new magazine that was to be created that would be a missions journal. Well, World Vision is a highly promotional organization that has been in business for many years. It's established with its constituency a certain pattern, and we were faced with the problem of introducing to the Christian public a new magazine that was not the house organ that they had become used to seeing under the banner World Vision. What they did was start another booklet that became their house organ called Scope, and World Vision magazine became a missions journal. Well, we had to do some experimentation to get people to try this new magazine. We couldn't say, because it would have been a negative sell in the copy, this is no longer a house organ, because we didn't want to sound like we were not for house organs, because we're for them very much. But we did have to show the distinctives of World Vision magazine as a Christian missions journal. So we started with an offer of 8 issues for $1, because we felt we had to give the people a chance to examine this magazine without too much risk. We tested 8 issues for $1 in different formats without the Yes-No stamp. We tried to get $2 for it. The kit that worked the best was the Yes-No kit, 8 issues for $1. Now, the Yes-No is a very interesting device. This gets the prospect involved in making a decision. And this became a very profitable kit. As the magazine matured and more people began to rely on it for good information and sound missionary journalism, it became necessary and it became possible for us to begin to ask for more money for the magazine and to ask for more money in the initial offer. So this last fall, we took our what we call our control kit, which was the 8 issues for $1, and we tested this kit, which is 15 issues for $2.88, against the 8 issues for $1. This kit proved out to be about 0.1% below the 8 issues for $1. And of course, obviously, when we're getting $2.88 for 15 issues, this is much better than 8 issues for $1, and this was necessary for the magazine to survive. So we were able, because of the tremendous acceptance that World Vision magazine has achieved over these 3.5 years, to go from a short-term subscription, which did not renew well, to a long-term situation, which of course will renew better. But we still have stuck with our Yes-No device. Now, we tested a tip-on card, we tested a jumbo-type format, but still the Yes-No kit works the best. Now, you might be interested in knowing how many no's come back. When Reader's Digest did this 5 or 6 years ago, they received 10 no's to every one. Yes. World Vision receives 2 no's to every 1 yes. But it still becomes a profitable mailing, and it gets people involved in a decision. And of course, this is the basic message of direct mail, is to get that customer involved with you. So this has worked and is working very well. In fact, there's a big mailing in the mail right now using this same kit. Let's go to the next kit. We're going to just spend a minute here, and then we're going on to some fundraising kits. Here is a follow-up kit for Campus Life magazine to kids who've dropped the magazine. We are interested in finding out whether we could get them to renew. Now, it's a different proposition to sell somebody something that they've already had. You can't spend a lot of time talking about benefits. They read the magazine and they canceled. So we relied here on a little gimmick, something to chew on, and we pasted in a... You'll see where we have two kinds here. I don't really know what kind was used in the test. One thing about direct mail, it's very difficult to keep samples in the shop. They're always being stolen. And I had a dickens of a time putting together these slides because it's so hard to get the samples. So that's why the two types of gum there. But you notice that we tipped the gum into the right close to the order form where that's perforated. And when the teenager got it, he was intrigued because he obviously had to open the envelope to get the gum. And we hoped he'd read the copy. And he did. And it worked very well. Now that's something we can get away with in a teenage magazine that would hardly be apropos for a Christian organization trying to raise funds. Now, these are applications of direct mail that are not as applicable to you as the ones that we'll see now. And I'd like us to take the next slide, which is the Youth for Christ Christmas mailing. Tried to put everything on this one slide so we could explain what we did. Before I get into that, let me give you a little history and so that you can understand what we did in this mailing. This is probably something that will interest each one of you because direct mail is becoming more and more a stabilizing influence in undergirding Christian organizations financially. And it's a very simple process, if it's followed scientifically, to build your mailing list and build your income. There's no mysticism to it. It's a simple matter of following some procedures. And I'm going to try to outline a case study here so that you can see what we've done here to take Youth for Christ International from one position to another. When we took the Youth for Christ account 4 years ago, they were mailing a Christmas seal letter to 20,000 people. They had been doing this for some 8 or 10 years. Youth for Christ had always been careful to keep accurate records. So it was possible for us to go back and look at each kit that had been sent, the percentage response, the average gift, and compare that against the graphics and the copy in the kit. We came to one conclusion. Every time they veered from a simple red, white, and green color format for combination, the response went down. Every time they did not use Keep Christ in Christmas or tried to talk about teenagers or anything else, again the response went down. So we took this information and we put together our first kit 3 years ago. They had been mailing to about 80,000 people, which includes their active donors and their magazine subscriptions at that time and also their cancelees. They mailed to about 80,000 people, and they were getting and enjoying a good response to that mailing. We were able to test some lists that first year because we were convinced that there were other lists besides Youth for Christ lists that would be responsive to a Christmas mailing. And here's a very important point. It's not enough to know that other outside lists work. You must be very careful in selecting lists that closely as possible approximate the profile of the house list. In other words, if we were going to mail to Youth for Christ house lists, we wouldn't go to Guidepost magazine and expect that list to pull for us. We went to lists that were close in profile to Youth for Christ International. We tested very small quantities the first year, but we did run 100,000 mailing. By sticking to the graphic combination that had worked over the years, and by putting the theme Keep Christ in Christmas on the stamps, by doing some technical things like isolating the response device so it was easy to send it back, we were able to increase their giving by 30% in that first year. But we also learned some very, very interesting things because we found that of the 10 lists we tested, 4 of them responded well enough so that we could increase our percentage next year and increase our mailing. So this year, this last Christmas, instead of going to, last Christmas, instead of going to 100,000, we were able to go up to about 180,000. And again, the mailing went up another 30%. Then we found that instead of having a universe of 180,000, we had tested enough lists so that we could mail to 300,000. And we again brought in more lists that met the profile. And this year, the giving again went up another third. I think my mathematics is right. I'm going to give you the total here in a minute. But the 300,000 names we're mailed to, the giving increased again, and we're now in the middle of planning next Christmas's mailing, where we will probably go to 500,000 people. Now, in that 3-year period, the giving of the Christmas letter, I think is fair to say, has quadrupled, and the net profit from the mailings has even been greater, because we've been doing larger runs, which of course has made it possible for our cost per thousand to be lower. Now, how do we do this? It can happen for you. As I said, there's no magic involved in it. You do have to have a saleable product. Youth for Christ International has a lot of things going for it. It's a well-respected organization that's had good leadership over the years and has proven itself in many, many areas so that they do have a committed constituency. It's important, if you are going to launch a program of testing outside lists, that you do it carefully. In the first list test that we did, on lists that we knew had a universe of 150,000, we only tested 3,000. The next year, if that worked, we didn't go all the way up to 150,000, we only went to 10,000. The next year, instead of going all the way up, we just went to 25,000. And it's only in this next couple of years that we'll be using all of the lists, all of the names of any one list, because we must always go gradually when we test. This is very, very important, or the whole thing can collapse on you and be an extremely costly lesson. We personalized a lot of our mail. Now, I think this is probably one of the most important things that we can talk about today, and that is the way that personalized first-class mail is ultimately going to revolutionize direct mail practices, not only for Christian organizations, but any nonprofit fundraising organization. And I'm sure many of you have been recipients of even merchandise mailings that have been first-class computer letters from Reader's Digest and Longines and people like this. We have found with the Youth for Christ mailing that the more mailings, the more names that we can autotype, the higher our response and the larger our gift. So you come to an impasse, of course, when you're mailing to 500,000 people. How can you possibly autotype 500,000 letters? If we were to start today, it would be impossible to autotype more than 100,000 for next Christmas. There is an exciting new development in direct mail that I predict within the next 3 years will take over direct mail solicitation, and that is the computer letter. It will be possible, instead of being able to do 2,000 letters a week, to do 2,000 letters an hour. So that it would be possible, all other things being equal, for us to have computer first-class letters to an entire mailing of 500,000 people. The response to a thing like that is, it just staggers the imagination in terms of the average gift and the percentage response. Just to give you an idea, when we do an autotype letter to people who have demonstrated they love us and give to us, we have seen as high, for instance, on our last year's Christmas seal givers, we autotyped all those this year, we saw a response, and I believe I'm correct in this, of 49%. Well, you know, a good percentage response to a direct mail fundraising campaign, even with a committed list, is, you know, 5 or 6 or 7%. But the personalized nature of the letter made it possible for us to increase our percentage and also to increase our average gift. These are new things that are being developed, and I would encourage you to keep aware so that when you begin to sophisticate your direct mail program, you're able to include personalized letters. It can be done on autotyping if your lists are small, and if your lists are large, it's possible now to be able to get consultation on actually doing computer letters and making it possible to give a personal message to your thousands of donors. Can you imagine what this could do for a college alumni program, where we could go in and write a program and do a computer letter, and we could say, Mr. Jones, it's been 15 years since you left Wheaton College, and a lot of things have changed since then. You better believe he'll read that letter. And when he does, he'll respond. Stanford University just did this. And with 20,000 alumni, I believe, raised over $100,000. So these are some of the exciting new developments that are taking place in direct mail. It's very important that you keep accurate records. We are now in the middle of analyzing our last year's Christmas mailing. Because of this, and because we were able to code the responses, and we can now make some judgments, and we can actually project within a very, very good degree of accuracy what the income will be next year for Youth for Christ from all of their direct mail mailings. And I say that because we were asked last year to submit a budget on what we felt their direct mail would do from their several mailings, and we have just finished that year, and we were on target. And again, there's no mysticism involved in this. It's a matter of numbers and statistics and careful planning. And you can have this kind of experience in your organization if you'll take the time to learn and apply these same principles. We're going to have a time of questioning. I'm sure I'm covering much of this material in a way that it wouldn't be possible for you to grasp it. I hope that when we get through that at least I've stimulated some questions so that we can probe it a little deeper. Let me just review this mailing for a minute. You see, we have an outer envelope, and right on the envelope we have that seal. The copy has not changed in the last 3 years. Accept these seals as a gift from Youth for Christ. Help us remind all America to keep Christ in Christmas. Now, there's some very strong, emotional, psychological reasoning behind that copy. All of us who are Christians bewail the fact that Christ is not in Christmas. But there's very little we can do about it. One of the things that this Christmas seal does is give people a tangible way of fighting back. And that's one of the secrets of this mailing. You'll notice the Christmas seals. We include, I think, 50 seals free in the mailing. You'll notice, of course, we have the letter. And again, with the letter, I'm going to talk a little bit about writing a letter, but the letter is a dramatization. It's a story of a conversion experience. Again, we're motivated, so the kinds of results we're looking for when we support an organization are results that are spiritual in nature. So it's necessary for us to give that kind of information in our donor letter. You'll notice down here, Christmas 67. This is a premium brochure, and when that opens up, right there we have three different types of premiums that we sell the benefits, and we give them any one of those free if they give us a gift. We have our business reply envelope. And there's our response device. You see, it's separate. It's not a part of the letter. It's not buried in a brochure, but it's right there so that they can get it. And then this year, we tested something for the first time, and that was a follow-up. You see the envelope over on the far right side there. You can just see a part of it. We repeat the premiums, and we put the Christmas seal graphics on there. And we found, to our surprise and pleasure, that by sending a follow-up letter 3 or 4 weeks after the initial mailing went out, that this also paid off for us and brought in a goodly number of responses. Let's have the next slide. I've just put two other direct mail kits in here to illustrate a point. This was done for the Evangelical Child Welfare Association in Chicago. The envelope, perhaps you can't read it, is a child with the question, "What's a mother?" And the copy says, "A mother usually is for keeps." We have some copy here that leads the prospect into a story and into involvement. And then we have a response device here that's tied to an envelope. Here's how you can help support children in foster homes. And then we have different ways and how much money it costs for each of those. Here we get the prospect involved in a choice. So he chooses whichever one of those items appeals to him the most. And then all he does is slip his check in, seal the envelope, and mail it in. Let's have the next slide, please. Here's a little bit of a gimmick, a little interest. When you're mailing to a mailing list 5, 6, 7, 10 times a year, it's very important that you change the pace. We had our midwinter convention in Youth for Christ in Seattle. We were fortunate in getting a lot of press play. And so we took the newspaper ID and made our envelope a newspaper. And then we put, here's some good news about teenagers. Because of a lot of bad news, we felt that would carry a good message and get the people into the envelope. And then the top of the letter is a reprint from the newspaper, and this is a quote right out of the newspaper, an answer, Youth for Christ, showing our people the acceptance of Youth for Christ in the local press. And here's a reprint of several articles, and the response card is over there, and that was our mailing for the month of February a couple of years ago. All right, I think we can have the lights. And before I open it to questions, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about how to write a letter. I know how many seminars I go to, and it's so easy to talk in principles like this, but many of you are faced with the problem of going home, and it's time for that monthly donor appeal, and it's your responsibility to come up with the letter. Now, there's many, many ways to write a donor letter, but I'm going to tell you how I write one, because I think it'll probably come as a surprise to you. I think a lot of people on the outside who are not in advertising, who are not writers, tend to think that we sit down and you know, just kind of dictate it into a dictating machine and have our secretary type it up. I wish it worked that way. I could write an awful lot more donor letters in a day. But instead of it being that way, many times it'll take 2 or 3 weeks to write a donor letter that will pull income. I'm going to trace for you. Here again, it's a little awkward for me to do this, but I only know about what I do. I can't tell you what anybody else does, so you're going to have to bear with me. Recently, every other month we do a donor letter for Youth for Christ. I'm using Youth for Christ today because they're happy to let me use this information. Other clients I have that I do donor letters for aren't necessarily as anxious for me to talk about it, and so I'm using Youth for Christ today as the example. February is Missions Month at Youth for Christ, and so our first job in writing a letter for missions is to isolate the problem of what do we talk about when we talk about missions and Youth for Christ. They're in many, many countries. They've got many activities. One of the first rules in writing a donor letter is only try to sell one idea. Many donor letters fail because they don't have an objective. And they spread out their objectives over so many different areas that it becomes almost impossible for the reader to get emotionally caught up in the situation. So we talked about missions. It was further decided in a conference that we would talk about India. We further decided that we would talk about nationals in India. So we now had isolated our objective so that we were going to tell the story of the development of nationals in India who are running the Youth for Christ program. Now, it's always good to have a biblical basis for your copy, because we're writing to people who are spiritually motivated, and they want to know that you are concerned about spiritual things. Well, there happens to be a verse in 2 Timothy 2:16, I believe it is, that says, "The same things that thou hast learned of me, commit thou to faithful men, who shall also be able to teach others." I think, and I'm preaching a little, that if missionary organizations had really taken that to heart 100 years ago, we'd have a different situation on a lot of mission fields today. But now my job in writing this letter was to figure out how to dramatize that 2 Timothy 2 principle. So I thought to myself, this is 2 or 3 weeks of thinking, by the way. I finally ended up writing the final draft of this letter in Washington, D.C., after I had been thinking about it for 2 weeks. But I remembered that a friend of mine, Joe Weatherly, had been sent to India in 1950. And I knew that the name of the national who was now running the program was Victor Monogram. And I wondered to myself, is it possible that Joe Weatherly was the one who picked Victor Monogram to run that program? Because if it would, it would make a great story. Of course, again, we have to have integrity. If it wasn't true, it doesn't matter if it makes a good story. You don't use it. I got on the phone and I called Joe Weatherly at Gospel Films and I said, "Do you know Victor Monogram?" "Do I know him?" He said, "For goodness sake, he was a clerk in a Bible bookstore in India when I went there. And I challenged him to come into the ministry. He came in first of all as an interpreter and then began to direct some of the rallies. And today he's leading that whole program." Well, now I had a story. I had dramatic evidence that Youth for Christ, and in particular Joe Weatherly, had taken the principle of 2 Timothy and they'd made it work. So I started out the letter by saying 20 years ago we sent our man Joe Weatherly to India. He was a man who believed in the principle laid out to Paul by Paul to Timothy, that his job was to pick a man. And then I explained with a little bit of secrecy and didn't give his name until I got down to that Victor Monogram is the man today. And then I talked about the work that Victor Monogram is doing. I talked about the men that he had chosen. And today, probably one of the best works of Youth for Christ anywhere in the world is being done in India because a man named Joe Weatherly believed in the principle of 2 Timothy and made it work. Now, you can't stop there. Then you have to show the need. Now, there's a desperate need in India because day by day, missionaries are being frozen out. And our hope, and the only hope of India, is for the national. So it was a legitimate thing for me to talk about the urgency of India and the need for trained nationals to be able to take over the work and do the job. But they need money. Youth for Christ has what's called a mobility fund, where they put money for special purposes. It's time now to put the Indian nationals on permanent support so that those mobility funds can be used for something else. Now that's the need. And now you have to ask for action. And here again is where many organizations fall down. The typical last paragraph is, "Thank you very much for remembering us in your prayers. God bless you." Well, that won't work. If you were sitting eyeball to eyeball across from a man and you were burdened about India and Victor Monogram and his work, you wouldn't end your luncheon by saying, "The Lord bless you." You'd ask him to participate. You'd tell him the need and you'd ask him to give you some money. So in a donor letter, if you're going to get that man to respond, you're going to have to ask for action. And so you do it by saying, "Right now, there's a desperate need for a specific amount of money, $3,000-$5,000 a year, so cheap to support those nationals. And if we're going to do that, it's going to mean that everybody is going to have to give sacrificially." Now, if you're sophisticated in your mailing so that you actually know this man and you're writing him a personal letter, you look back at his giving pattern. And he has a pattern. He'll give you $10 or $25 or $100. So when you come to the action paragraph in your letter, instead of just saying, "Give sacrificially," you say, "I would like you to pray right now about giving us $100, if that's what he gave you the last time. Or $50 or $5. But be specific. Now, the evidence and the excitement of a thing like this is this. That when we were able to get IBM cards into Youth for Christ so that we knew exactly how much money was being given, by whom, we could isolate all of our $5 givers so that when we came to that portion in the letter where we needed action, we could say, "We want $5. We also tried something else. We split that list and we asked people who gave $5 if they'd give 10. 50% of them gave 10. You see? So you've got a veritable gold mine in your mailing list. If you do a fantastic job of public relations by not just asking for money, but by selling them on what you're doing, those people become more and more interested in your program, and every time you go to them, they're not only a prospect for what they gave you last time, but if you'll ask, it's quite possible that you'll get even more. Now let me give you just a formula for writing a letter. First of all, you can't possibly write a good donor letter unless you're a genius without 5 or 6 or 7 rewrites. So don't think you're not a writer just because it doesn't come that way. It doesn't matter what kind of a writer you are, it takes work. I have a man who works for me who's done work for Capitol Records and Columbia Records and Belltone and Banker's Life and Encyclopedia Britannica. It takes him 5 or 6 hours to write a donor letter because it's that amount of work. You have to find something to hang your hat on first. You have to find an idea. The idea in this letter was 2 Timothy 2. And that was on the outer envelope, by the way. "Commit thou the same unto faithful men." That's on the outer envelope. One other illustration like this, and then we'll open up for questions. Trinity Seminary and College is a client of ours. Here now, most people say, "You can't write a donor letter for a college. That's hard to do." Well, with Trinity, we have constituents of the Evangelical Free Church who are really committed to education. So they let us talk to their whole constituency. Well, what is one of the distinctives of Trinity? Seminary and college. I don't expect you to answer that. I'll tell you what it is. It is that they stand very firm on the authority of the Scriptures. That the market, the Evangelical Free Church, is very committed to making sure that Trinity College and Seminary stays true to the authority of the Scriptures. So in our donor letter that will be going out next month, we're using as our theme, "Every man did what was right in his own eyes." That's on the outer envelope. You know where that's from? It's from Judges. It depicts the moral depravity of the children of Israel when they had no king. Then we're offering a booklet, "The Incomparable Book" by Wilbur Smith, who happens to be a faculty member at Trinity. And then we're talking in that letter about the fact that the kind of education that puts the Bible at the center is expensive. And then we take off from that and we motivate those people and ask them to share and participate in continuing to provide the kind of education that makes the Bible central. Now, the Evangelical Free Church are the kind of people who can respond to that kind of a proposition. But just to write a general letter and say we need money wouldn't work. But we're doing something else here besides getting money. We are telling that constituency something that blesses their heart and encourages them and instills confidence in them so that they'll continue to give to us. Now, a little formula. Rudolf Flesch has a formula for writing letters. It goes like this. 12 words to every sentence, 3 sentences to every paragraph, and 80% of your words should be 2 syllable or less. Now, you see, if you do that, it'll take rewriting, because most of us don't think in 2-syllable words. It'd be good if we did, but we don't. One of the things you need to do when you write a letter is not worry how you say it. Get everything down on paper you want to talk about. Then go through and write it again, and then go through and organize it again. And the last thing you should do is try to get your letter to fit this formula. This is the thing that gives a letter what's called IPP, indefinable psychological push. And that's the kind of intensity that gets people to respond. If you don't have that in your letter, you won't have as good a results in the mail coming back. Now, we've covered an awful lot of ground. I hope that I've been helpful, and I'd certainly like to answer questions. And let's open it up to that now.
When you get a question, if you can't repeat it, allude to it in such a way that whoever's listening to this thing will know what you're talking about.
All right, I'll do it. Yes, Norm. How long should a letter be? Well, I'm sure you've heard the answer to that. It's about as long as your legs, just enough to touch the ground. There's no length for a letter. You have to tell your story. I've seen 4-page letters that have worked like crazy, and I've seen 1-page letters that have worked equally as well. And the only thing, you should be flexible, because sometimes it takes 4 pages. I never forget a letter we wrote for NAE, where we used the theme, "All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." And we took off on Madeline Murray and atheism. And it took 4 pages to tell that story. But it also got us a tremendous response. So I don't think we can come to any answer except tell your story. And please don't inhibit yourself when you start to write a letter by saying this has got to be 1 page. Write the letter. And then see how long it is. And then go back if you have to get it on 1 page and edit it. But don't try to write to a specific piece of paper or it'll immobilize you. Yes?
Would you recommend a monthly letter or various forms of publications that would do the same job as a letter?
Do I recommend a monthly letter or other publications that would do the same job? Well, I would say that our experience is teaching us that you can mail to your mailing list almost every month, if it's done in good taste, without it affecting your response. Now, we've taken some clients who, for instance, mailed only 2x a year. When you are able to evaluate your response with an IBM, so you have reports, you'll find that very few of your people give every time. Most of them maybe give, Bob, what would it be?
Well, 80% will give only once a year.
80% will give once a year. Well, if you're only mailing once a year, you're not taking advantage of all the people who might give it a different time for a different economic reason or for a different spiritual reason. There may be very many different facets to your work. And you can't cover them in every letter. Somebody may respond to the authority of the Scripture letter for Trinity with great enthusiasm, where they might talk about a year-end budget letter and not want to respond to that at all. So I would say there's no fast rule, but we're learning that you can mail many, many times without offending, and you do increase your giving because you get more people on your mailing list involved more times a year. Yes?
Maybe a reply envelope. Is there any way of putting it together? What's on the outside so when they open it?
What is the way to arrange the pieces of a direct mail piece within the envelope? Well, first of all, it's usually wise to use a window envelope so that your response device has a label on it so that you can read it when it comes back, and it also makes it easier for the person to respond. So if you're using that method, the first thing that would go in the envelope next to the window would be the response device. I don't think it really matters whether the letter or the brochure or the card or the BRE or what order they're in. The only thing that you shouldn't do is nest them. Don't make it one package so that when they pull it out, it's all together. Make them separate pieces. I don't think, I don't have any experience that would tell me it's better to put the letter after the response device rather than the brochure. Other questions? I think you've raised a good point. In fact, I would say that I don't have any tests on this that I can quote, but I think we would say that if we were doing a first-class letter, that we wouldn't be as interested in having an outer envelope message. I wouldn't say we wouldn't, but I think in most cases we don't. When you're doing third-class mail, however, and when you're competing with Life magazine and Time, the outer envelope becomes a sales vehicle, and you want to create curiosity and overcome inertia, which, of course, is your biggest problem in direct mail. They just let it lay there. And you've got to do something to get them inside. If it's a first-class letter, most people hope from first-class mail. Another hand...
How do you go about improving the size of your mailing list? You said on Youth for Christ, you went from something like 20,000 up to 500,000. Where did you get the name? Do you buy mailing lists?
We don't buy them, we rent them. So that there's two things we're doing here. We rent a list and test it. And if it works, we'll mail to the whole list. For instance, this last year, we added about 10,000 new names to our list of people who responded from rented lists. They now are a part of our list. So this is the way you build your permanent list, but you continually rent lists from the outside and test them, and that's how you continue to build a bigger universe.
Where do you find these lists?
Well, they're available through list brokers. Publishers Mailing House in New York is a good one. In fact, probably the best all-around one, Publishers Mailing House in New York. There are some others that have some good lists and others that are not so good. Sometimes you can get other Christian organizations to trade with you. This is always good if you can exchange with them, if they're in a non-competitive field and it's something they are willing to do. How do we purge a list?
Mm-hmm.
Well, every client has to decide for himself how long he wants to leave a name on a mailing list. But ultimately, it becomes unprofitable to mail to him. You need to purge it. And this is done by, well, several ways. Writing a personal letter saying, we want to keep you informed, but we haven't heard from you. And usually you introduce the copy idea of stewardship and not wanting to waste God's money. And using some kind of a device so they can say, no, I don't want to be on your mailing list. That's a way to do it if you don't really want to get rid of them. Because then they have to send back, no, I don't want you to send me any more mail. When you do that, you'll probably pay for your mailing to those people. And then the ones who really say that, you'll want to eliminate them. I know of a client who got, no, I don't want to be on your mailing list, and sent a check along with the no. So, Lord, increase their tribe. Yes, back there. The question is the advisability and cost of getting professional help in this area. I really don't think it's possible for me to answer that. I think it depends. That's kind of like saying sick 'em to a dog, you know. Let's put it this way. I think it's advisable that anybody who has, who wants to build a successful direct mail program, seek outside help. I don't think most organizations have the talent within them to do this kind of thing successfully. At least I know very few. As far as the cost is concerned, I would only say this, that you need to look at the cost in terms of the return that the outside agency is able to get for you. Most of the time, clients are shocked by the prices that outside agencies charge, because they're used to getting everything for nothing. Well, I don't have people working for me who come to work for me because I'm in the Lord's work. So I have to pay competitive salaries. I pay one of my copywriters almost $20,000 a year, but he earns that. I have artists that I pay up in that same area. Well, if I come to work for you or an agency like the Walter Bennett Agency, these people have to pay competitive wages. And if they're paying competitive wages, there's only one thing they can do, and that's charge the client. And the thing you have to evaluate is, can they render enough service and increase my giving so that I can justify it? And obviously, they better be able to do that, or you don't need them. You mean for a client?
Well, yes, those that you use when you're being engaged. Like such as those that were in your circulars.
Yes, those were created and produced by us, yes.
You do just that as a service in your business?
You mean just create brochures?
Yes.
Not if I can help it. What we like to do is get involved with the client on a total program. I wouldn't say we wouldn't do it, but not usually. Because there's too many elements involved in a direct mail kit that have to be right for it to work. And I have a little speech. If you want me to be accountable for the results, then I have to have something to say about everything that goes into the envelope. Yes. I think that's a private judgment that every client has to make for himself, but I would like to make a little sales presentation for list rentals and exchanges. If it's in a non-competitive field, there are evidences that this helps your list in terms of its response to your proposition. Let me illustrate. If you have a list that you're mailing to five times a year, and you let it out to a merchandise, let's assume it's a non-profit organization, obviously, you wouldn't rent your list to somebody else who was asking for funds. That's not usually done. But let's assume you rented it to Word or some people who are involved in merchandising. If you can get those people to respond to another proposition, that puts them that much further down the road in terms of becoming a mail order buyer. And that helps your cause. Now, there are times when it probably wouldn't be wise. For instance, I would not want to see Youth for Christ rent their list to somebody in November with us doing the Christmas mailing in November. I just probably wouldn't want to see that happen. But I think there can be an awful lot more done in this area, and I think it would help all of us if there could be trust and confidence so that it'd be possible for all of us to get to more people. Well, to your first question, I think this is a matter for you to decide. I'm not going to decide for you whether it's a sacred trust. My own attitude, and I'm biased obviously, is that if I can give another Christian an opportunity to be exposed to products and services that will help him in his spiritual growth or in any area of his life, I think I'm giving him something worthwhile. I think if you're immoral and you let it out to anybody and you don't check who it is and what it is, then I think that you're violating a trust. As far as what you should do with an envelope, whether you should let the stamp be paid by the customer, I think that depends, again, on the nature of the organization. I think that there's great appeal to a non-profit religious organization appealing for funds to let the person put the stamp on. But I also know that if you will put a hand stamp on a return envelope, that it will increase your response tremendously. I think there was a day when the negative appeal there, help us save the Lord's money by putting your own stamp on, was valid. I'm not so sure that it is as valid today. And in fact, I know it doesn't work as well. I know it doesn't, because if you'll put a hand-stamped return, stamp an envelope personally, you'll bump up your response considerably. Yes, sir. The usual answer to that is that it'll justify the expense of hand stamping. The response will be enough more to justify doing it. Maybe Frank and Robbie has statistics on that, do you?
We found out that by putting the stamps on instead of using the business supply envelope, we increased the response by 5 times the cost of the stamps or more. So we were way, way ahead.
Good, thank you. Other questions? Yes, sir. No, right.
Most of the materials that you demonstrated here had supplementary materials in addition to the letter and the reply card. I was wondering, how many pieces of literature do you put in before the envelope becomes cluttered, or the individual, when he gets it, he says, it's another pile of stuff, and he dumps the whole thing?
Well, first of all, in all the examples I showed you, all of the information was coordinated and had something to do with that particular mailing. So that's one set of problems. I mean, if somebody's going to throw it away, they're going to throw it away anyway. I think we have to understand a philosophy of advertising. When you look through a magazine, you select the advertisements you want to read. When you watch television, you select the television commercials you want to watch. When 10 pieces of direct mail come to your house, you select the pieces you want to read, and you throw the others in the waste paper basket. And direct mail is built on the percentage business. We know that we have to have, in some propositions, 0.5% is profitable. Some it has to be 5%. So you can't worry about the people who are going to throw it away if you've done the best job possible in integrating your mailing.
In an effort to retain simplicity, is there a point at which you can get too much into your mailing?
That depends. I don't think there's a premium on simplicity, but because it's complicated doesn't mean it will work better. In fact, I just saw a mailing the other day where it was extremely simple, and it worked better than a very complicated mailing. But many times the exact opposite is true. It comes again to what it takes to do the job. You shouldn't approach every direct mail kit with, we must have a brochure, we must have a letter, there are a couple of things you have to have. You have to have a response device. You ought to have a response envelope. And you ought to have a letter. But whether you have a brochure depends really on what you're trying to sell. Now, you ask another question about how many pieces can you put in an envelope before it becomes cluttered. There are many merchandising houses who will put 20 and 30 different unrelated products in an envelope, and the mailing will pay out. Now, those don't appeal to me. I throw them away. But there are many people who respond to that.
But your recommendation that you always have a response card in addition to the envelope?
Is it my recommendation that we always have a response card in addition to the letter?
In addition to the response envelope that you would enclose your gift or whatever reply you're seeking?
I would say yes. There could be some variations. You saw one of the kits there where we used the inside of the envelope as the response device. There was a budget problem, and we compromised. But I would say under normal circumstances, there ought to be a separate response device in your mailing. Yes?
Are there different times of the year when mailings are more productive? Financial?
Well,
are there dry times of the year?
Are there times of the year when it's more profitable to mail? That, again, depends on what you're mailing. I was talking with a client just recently about this. There are some times when August is a great month. But I would say if I was starting with a new client, I wouldn't probably mail in August. I would mail sometime between September and March. But again, I've seen some of our greatest successes come in May and June. But when you're starting a direct mail program, it's best to stay within some safe guidelines and then expand your program after you get a certain amount of confidence. Yes? Is there any psychology to changing the colors in your envelope? I would say that your mailings ought to have a change of pace. A couple of years ago, in fact, Robert Stone wrote a book on direct mail where he devoted two or three chapters to colors. And he's given speeches recently where he's laughed about the importance he put on color, because it's almost impossible to state that one color will outpull another. Now, there are obviously warm colors, and there are bad colors for anything. But if all things being equal, one color is not going to make the difference. But your mailing should have a change of pace. Shouldn't always be a number 10 envelope, but it shouldn't always be white. You should always be changing your pace so that they don't get the feeling, oh, I've already seen that. Yes? The question is, will I always include a reply envelope, even if I wasn't making a strong appeal in the letter for finances? I always want to give people an opportunity to give. And I don't think you can afford to go to the mail without giving them some kind of an opportunity to respond. No, I would say in general, for a general principle, that every time you go to your mailing list, you ought to have give them an opportunity to respond. Yes?
How large a mailing list would you say is economically sound? Is there any particular size of list? 5,000, 20,000, 500?
Well, if you're going to deal with
the kind of...
Yes, there is. The question is, how many customers or prospects or donors do you have to have before you can get involved in this kind of mailing? I would say that your break-even point or your profitable point would probably come at about 10,000. But I have to add that that wouldn't discourage me from doing this kind of thing before, because you have to get from where you are to where you want to be. And it may mean a subsidization program until you can build your list. And there are compromises you can make on your way up. But there are certain things it takes to build a mailing list and to get response, and you can't fall short of that. But obviously, if you have 10,000 names of active donors, you've got a chance of making money every time you mail. Any other questions? You mean if you're going to test a list? This would depend on the universe or the total number of the list. For instance, one of the things we're plagued with in our market is a lot of small lists. If you've only got 5,000, it may be a very good list. Well, you'd only have to test probably 1,000 of that to find out how it would respond totally. If you've got 500,000, you probably couldn't, you'd have to test it in stages. You wouldn't dare test 50,000 at one time of an unknown list. So you might start with 10,000 of that list, and if it worked, the next time you mailed, you might go to 25 and then 50, but it would take you 5 or 6 mailings before you'd ever get to the place where you'd be blasting, that's what we call blasting the whole list. You have to be very cautious, because this is statistical business, and sometimes they can play tricks on you. Yes.
Do you have any observations on the difference between a response device that offers a free gift only and one which offers a gift with options to give?
Let me see if I understand your question properly. We're going into the mail with a proposition, and we're saying, if you give us a gift of $5, you'll get this free gift over against...
We want to offer you this month a free gift.
Whether you give or not. My experience has been that if you don't specify that the gift cannot be given, the free gift cannot be given unless they give, you'll get a lot of people who will write and ask for something for nothing, and it would be very expensive. And although this is a very delicate point, because you don't want to sound commercial in your letter. You know, I tell you, what am I going to do? If you'll send me $5, I've got this wonderful gift for you. But you've got to say it in such a way that it's in good taste. But you do need to protect yourself against just giving away a valuable little book at 20 or 30 cents and not getting a return. You can't afford to do that.
I'd like broader experience. We tried a measurement on this a couple months ago for the first time. Only sent 5,000 and just offered a free gift. But we got a good response, more from that 5,000 than we did from 35,000 of the kind that had an optional gift. One out of four sent an unsolicited gift, and far more than paid for the book.
Well, then you've got experience that I don't have, and if it works on your list, you ought to keep doing it. I have not had that kind of experience. Yes.
You mentioned 10,000 being the profitable mailing. Is that the personalized mail? Can it be profitable with less than that personalized?
Yes. If it was, the question is, if it was personalized mail, would it be profitable at less than 10,000? I think the answer would be yes. If there are people who've already demonstrated they love you and have given to you. Yes.
Is there any trend in direct mail in these, in the last, say, 6 to 8 to 10 months? Or the trend from 4 years down to 6 to 8 months, not only in religious mailing but other mailing, that would suggest that mailing is much more difficult now to get responses than it has been before? Is that a fair question?
It's a fair question, but I think the answer is no. The question is, does it look like the response to direct mail is deteriorating?
Or, not necessarily deteriorating, is there a trend toward increasing our response?
Well,
the same thing 4 years ago with a certain amount of variety, is it achieving less or more if you have any control?
I would say in non-profit organizations that giving is up over a 4-year period. I think that would be my experience. But, of course, we're getting so much more sophisticated. We're getting so much more information available to us so that we are able to do things that we couldn't do before. And this, of course, contributes to the upswing. Yes?
Aren't people hardened to the trick of customizing robo-letters?
Aren't people aware of the fact they're getting a customized letter? I would say that evidence shows no. The response is too phenomenal. Now, it could be, of course, that they are aware of it and it doesn't matter to them. I don't know that. But I had a very interesting experience just recently with my... two very interesting experiences. I received a personal letter from an organization that I've never given to in my life. It was signed by the president, whom I knew. And I put that letter aside... And I began to worry about it. Picked it up again, and he wanted $500. And he had outguessed his prospect. He didn't have anybody that had that much money. But you know, I ended up sending him $100, and I'd never given a gift in my life before, and I knew it was an autotype letter, and I knew he'd never seen it. The power of a personal letter is just phenomenal. And I had the funniest thing happen the other day. Evangelist John Haggai is going to Indonesia. Is it Indonesia? And he wrote a letter to a group of laymen and asked them to go with him. He wrote me one, because I'm a good friend of his, and it came to our house. And my wife said, Russ, you're going to have to call John and tell him whether you're going to Indonesia or not. I said, why? Well, here's this letter. And I said, well, for, you know, I said, he autotyped that letter. He probably doesn't even know it came to me. And I had to spend 5 minutes convincing my wife that I wasn't being downright rude in not calling John and telling him I was sorry I couldn't go on his trip with him. And this shows you the tremendous power of a personal letter. Any other questions? Yes.
You just called that letter on John because the person who selected your name, I know from a list of quite a few others, so you missed the mark.
Well, that only proves that I've become so cynical I don't believe anybody anymore. Well, I think John Hagee ought to know me better than to think that I could afford to take as much time as he wanted me to take and go to Indonesia. I'd say he misguessed his prospect. His faith, not mine, I guess. Huh. Any other questions?
You don't have the sophisticated machinery to keep tabs on the giving record of your constituency. Would you still follow through with the idea of suggesting an amount that they should give if you have a given project? I mean, would in some cases enhance your giving, but in others, wouldn't this, limit those that would think in terms of larger gifts?
The question is, if you don't know how much your givers are giving, can you still use a specific amount in the action paragraph? I think you do have a problem, but I would think that even without a computer or an IBM card system, you could isolate your givers who are doing more than $20 or $30 and ask them for a specific amount. For the rest of them, you probably would have to be specific only at the $5 level, because if you make it too high, you do eliminate those people who would say, well, if he wants $50, my dollar wouldn't do him any good. And, of course, as we all know, it's the dollar bills that keep us in business. Yes, Russ.
Is it possible to ask for individual gifts plus a commitment by direct mail, or is this unadvisable?
That's a good point. Is it possible to ask for a cash gift and then a pledge as well? We just did this in our missions letter, the one I talked to you about, Joe Weatherly. We asked for a cash gift of so much, and then we asked people if they would be willing to commit themselves to the support toward the support of a national worker in India. And you'll pick up both. But the other one is a throwaway line. You don't spend two paragraphs, one on the cash gift and one on the pledge. You emphasize the cash gift, and then you get a throwaway line in, by the way. And then on your response card, you say, here is my cash gift for $10. I commit myself to so much money a month as the Lord enables me. Make sure that on the card, there's room for both. Yes. Do I have any... I heard the other day that they're now trying to develop a machine that will handwrite letters. So that would be a way to do it. The question is there a way to personalize letters without autotyping? There is a system that's called matching that we have had some experience with, but not good experience. The procedure is that you type your letter, and then it's printed, offset, and then they bring it back, and they match it to the same typewriter that it was the original letter was printed on, and then they type in the salutation. Doesn't work too well, and for some reason it doesn't have the authenticity. I say that with qualifications. We had a bad letter shop do it for us, and we weren't happy. I would say it's an option you ought to try if you're in a town big enough that has a big letter shop, but it wouldn't be possible in a small town. They wouldn't even know what you were talking about. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
What are the merits of printed, handwritten signatures versus the handwritten signature? Does it pay if you have somebody who can scrawl out a handwritten pen signature versus one that's printed, say, in blue ink, or one that's printed in black ink?
I would say that tests have shown that it pays to run the signature in blue ink. You can pay for the cost of doing that, but that there's no... I do not know of any value in having anybody personally sign letters when they're printed. The exciting thing at this, I was at a computer school a couple of weeks ago where we were discussing the applications of the computer to direct mail. And there's now a device out that not only will type a letter, 2,000 an hour, but as it comes off the burster, it automatically signs the name in blue ink. It's a, there's going to be some fantastic things happening next year in this field. We have time for one more question, then I think we better close up shop. Yes, sir.
Earlier you gave some names and books that would be good for direct mailing. Could you repeat those, please?
Yes, I think anybody who's involved in writing donor letters should subscribe to the Reporter of Direct Mail. This is a magazine that covers the whole field of fundraising very well and understands your needs. In fact, I would suggest you join the Direct Mail Advertising Association. It's New York, and that's not very specific, is it? It's on Park Avenue in New York. The Direct Mail Advertising Association, if you call the Los Angeles Direct Mail Association, if you live in Los Angeles, they'll tell you. If you live in Chicago, you can get it there. If you want to take down my address, I'll be glad to get it for you. 230 Park Avenue. There it is. New York. The Direct Mail Advertising Association. Costs you $125 a year. There are a couple of good books out. How to Write a Good Advertisement by Victor Schwab. It's a very good book. If you get the Reporter Direct Mail, you'll find just tremendous resource material in there that'll help you with almost any of your problems. And if you're a member of the DMAA, you can write to them and they will give you counsel. They'll send you formats of different appeal letters, and then they have seminars. And in fact, they have a school that goes for a week where they sit down and teach you how to write copy. And very, very interesting and something that an awful lot of Christian organizations ought to take advantage of. Well, you've been a wonderful audience. I appreciate so much your patience. Thank you very much.